This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
We're really delighted to have Susan Faludi with us this evening. You know, some of Susan's best writing over the years has been, of course, on gender issues, starting with her coverage of feminism as a journalist in the 1980s. Her 1991 award-winning book, Backlash, remains an important reassertion of feminist tenets. And a later book, Stiffed, in 1999, assessed the state of American manhood. Her new book, In the Dark Room, is her most personal and very intensely so. At the center is the remarkable tale of her father, from whom she was estranged for many years, and who dared her to, quote, write my story after disclosing in 2004 that at the age of 76, he had undergone gender reassignment surgery. Her dad proved to be a massive jigsaw puzzle for her, and digging into the past was quite challenging. My most difficult repertorial subject is how Susan described her dad in a recent interview. But the book is about more than her father's metamorphosis or more than an inquiry into the meaning of gender. It is those things, but it's also a very moving, provocative, and multi-layered examination of identity, whether identity in the name of truer self-expression or more darkly in the interest of nationalism or xenophobia. Maureen Corrigan, reviewing the book for National Public Radio, called it especially pertinent reading in, quote, our own dark times when questions of identity keep coming to the fore as matters of life and death. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Susan Faludi.
Can you all hear me? Good. Thank you for that. That was a wonderful description. I've read some really odd descriptions in my book that actually encapsulated it. You know, last time I was here was, I think, for my third book, The Terror Dream, and it was 2007, and this book was well underway by then. And I remember thinking, as hard as it is to go against the culture on matters of national security, it would be way more terrifying to be up here holding forth about my relationship with my father. So here I am now. We'll see how it goes. I'm also very glad to see some dear friends here who've been kind enough to put up with my long reluctance to go into what I've been working on for the last decade. So thank you for your tolerance. It's really great to see you here. I thought I'd start out where my book starts out, with an email I received from my father 12 years ago. It began, to Susan C. Faludi, date 7/7/2004, subject, changes. Dear Susan, I've got some interesting news for you. I have decided that I have had enough of impersonating a macho aggressive man that I've never been inside. Now, attached to this message was a series of snapshots. In the first, my father is standing in a hospital lobby in a sheer sleeveless chemise and red skirt. And the caption read, "I look tired after the surgery." In another, taken some months before the surgery, my father is perched amid a copse of trees, modeling a henna wig with bangs and a ruffled blouse. The caption read, "Stephanie in Vienna Garden." Okay, so that's the email I got. Naturally, this surprised me. Also, understand when my father flew to Thailand to get gender reassignment surgery, she was 76 years old. And on top of that, we had been pretty much alienated from each other. My father and I had barely spoken in a quarter century. Truth be told, we never had a very good relationship. When I was growing up, my father was, as she described it, aggressive, also autocratic, domineering, and even violent, as I relate in the book. All of which fueled my early feminism. Now, some of you know my previous work, and you know that I write about political and public issues and not so much personal stuff. So this is a big departure for me, and a bit of a scary one, but it was also what my father wanted. In the phone call that followed the email, my father said, "Why don't you come over here and basically interview me and recount my story?" So that was the beginning of this project. So a couple of months after the email, I jumped on a plane to Hungary, which was where my father was living. In 1990, my father had returned to the country where she had grown up. On this first visit and subsequent ones, we pursued the process of getting to know each other again. For me, probably the least difficult part of that journey was coming to accept my father as a woman. Far harder was dealing with all the ghosts that haunted both of us from our past. And clearly my father's identity quest, which had culminated in her surgery, was intertwined with many other aspects of her life. So, apropos that, I want to read first an excerpt that suggests how her life as a woman was entwined with her life as a father. You still can, you can hear me from this angle? Okay. Can't really see you over the microphone. Maybe I'll pull it down a little. My father broke into a run, pounding across the plaza to the entrance of a 10-story commercial building a few blocks from the Danube on the Buda side of the river, skirt rustling, black pumps clacking on the concrete. She jammed a leg in the glass door just as it was closing behind a mail carrier. We had arrived at her doctor's office. "They locked the entrance," she called over her shoulder. "Come on." We took the elevator to an upper floor in a waiting area at the end of a long, tatty... We took the elevator to an upper floor in a waiting area at the end of a long, tatty corridor. Two sagging vinyl couches were pushed up against opposing walls. The scruffy carpet was balding and matched the mud color of the couches. A line of baby photos was thumbtacked to one wall. "Don't you want one of these?" My father was pointing at the baby pictures. I pretended not to hear and studied the large plaque to the right of them. Dr. Andre Mijli, Obstetrics and Gynecology. The inner door swung open before she could ask me again. A very tan and silver-haired gent in an Izod shirt and doctor's smock greeted us. "Keze chokolom," he said to me. This is the old-fashioned Hungarian greeting from a man to a woman. It means, "I kiss your hand." And then, turning to my father, "Kese, chokolom." My father grinned and gave me a nudge. We followed the gynecologist into his consulting room, a small space with a cluttered desk and a credenza lined with sports trophies. My father settled her pocketbook on her lap and began chatting away in Hungarian. The bronze Dr. Mijli beamed and nodded affably. After a while, he made some notes on a prescription pad, tore out the sheet, and handed it to my father, a refill for her estrogen. My father deposited the slip in her purse. "I was just telling Dr. Mijli," my father said, turning to me, "that I am the mother of you." She made air quotes with her fingers. "Who," my father added, "is not a mother." "Who?" I said. "You. Not yet, anyway." "How did he get these trophies?" I asked. I was changing the subject. "Dr. Mijli is a great yachtsman," my father explained. "He has a 20-foot boat, and he's won many prizes." She translated her flattery to Captain Mijli, who beamed some more. They carried on for a while, my father pointing a finger at me from time to time. I should note here that I do not, despite a year of Hungarian lessons, can, you know, say hello, goodbye, and can I have a glass of wine, and that's about it. Also, sometimes two glasses of wine, depending on the day my father and I had. They carried on for a while, my father pointing a finger at me from time to time. I'm telling him about your problem, my father said. Problem? There may be physical reasons. There are no... Dr. Measley put away his prescription pad. I pulled out my reporter's notebook. Can I ask a few questions? I said. Dr. Measley indicated through my father that he was amenable. Do you see a difference since the operation? The doctor dawdled with his answer. He says my face is very nice now, my father translated. He says I have very few wrinkles for a man my age. What I meant, I said, was, does Dr. Measley see a difference in your personality? The reply was longer in coming. Dr. Measley says that I'm a happy man, my father related. A happy person, she corrected herself. Dr. Measley says this is very important because we don't know how many years a life brings, but at least a person must live it in happiness. Dr. Measley, I thought, dispenses platitudes as well as pharmaceuticals. Is my father one of your more, I turned over adjectives in my mind, unusual patients? The answer came back through the linguistic bucket brigade. He says he has one even more unusual, my father said. He brought into the world a girl who was 12 years old. This did sound unusual. The patient was 12 years old, my father amended. She came to the hospital and she didn't know she was pregnant. He had to cut open that thing. What thing? You know, where the vagina is. The hymen? Right. I still wasn't following. Sperm got smeared on her somehow, my father related. There was a little hole in the hymen. The sperm got in. Somehow? My father conferred again with the doctor. The girl got raped. My pen froze over my notepad. Another round of Hungarian. It was her father, my father said. Christ, I said. Dr. Measley beamed. Dr. Measley wants to know how old you are, my father said. 49, I said, and thought peevishly, don't you know? The two conferred. He says you look much younger, my father said. Like me, she added. And then, after a few more minutes, Dr. Measley says that he once had a patient who had her first baby past 48. So this is your last chance. Dr. Measley wants to know if you've tried fertility treatments. I don't. Dr. Measley says you should monitor your ovulation. The gynecologist reached into a drawer and pulled out a small plastic device shaped like a kazoo. You spit into it, my father translated, and it tells you on the days you are impregnable. Impregnable? Whether you can have a baby, my father elbowed me. Okay, dear, he says, now he can do the exam. No thanks, I said, but he's got free time. I don't want an exam. You want to come back? No, I... The doctor reached into his desk and handed me a flyer, an advertisement for Mini Microsoap, the ovulation monitor. On the front, in girlish pink script and in English, it said, maybe, baby. It will only take 10 minutes, my father said. No! My father snatched up her purse and headed for the door, her face contracting into a familiar scowl. We rode the elevator in silence. Downstairs, we stopped at the pharmacy. She had to pick up her hormones and found our place at the end of a long queue. I could feel my father appraising me. This business of no children, she said, it's not normal. When the prescription was finally ready, my father snatched it from the counter and flung herself through the door. I had to hurry not to lose her as she clacked furiously down a warren of back streets, her white pocketbook swinging like a mainsail from the gaff of a bunched shoulder. At one point, she disappeared around a corner, and I was overcome with a childlike terror of being lost. I caught sight of the flapping purse again as we reached Moskva Ter, the city's huge transport junction still bearing then its communist-era name. I followed at my father's heels as she crossed several sets of railroad tracks and came to rest on the platform for the number 59. Some minutes into our wait, my father broke the silence. "Everything reproduces," she said. "Birds, bees, even these little weeds in the ground." She gestured toward a tuft of crabgrass pushing through a crack in the pavement. I looked down the tracks, willing the tram to come. "Without children, your existence has no meaning," my father said. And, when I didn't answer, "Your books will stop selling. People will forget all about what you wrote." I kept my eyes on the rails. "It's the most important thing," she said. I turned to face her. "Family," she finished. If family meant so much, I thought, and didn't say, why had she cut herself off from the one she was born into and the one she had sired? Wasn't she still cutting herself off? "I'm Steffi now," she liked to say. From her whole fraught history as a troubled son, an embattled husband and father. But what if something else was going on? "My daughter likes me now," my father had told her new trans friends at the party she hosted in my honor. "She comes to see me." I thought of the headline in the article in Mashok magazine. "Stefania, a chalad, apa," which means Stefania, the father. An ear-piercing screech of metal wheels announced the approach of the tram. My father fixed a sharp eye on me. "You are ending the family," she said. "When a family gets discontinued, it's suicide. For all these people who lived, all these people who came before you." She wasn't wrong, I thought. I had denied her family. Not just by failing to have children, but by letting our estrangement drag on for so many years. It was the latter that caused me shame. So to come to grips with my father's story, I had to confront a whole series of questions about identity. And ultimately, I had to ask myself, what is identity anyway? Is identity what we choose to be, or is it the very thing that we can't escape? For my father's part, my father grew up Jewish, then named István Friedman, an only child of wealthy parents in Budapest, and lived a life of privilege until World War II, when large numbers of our family would perish in the Holocaust. My teenage father survived by his wits on the streets of Budapest, passing as Christian with a false identity papers and a stolen fascist armband. One time he would use this armband to pose as a Hungarian Nazi Arrow Cross officer to rescue his parents from a protected house whose residents were about to be killed. And this is one of the stories I tell in the book. After the war, my father would go on to other identity reinventions, documentary photographer and filmmaker in the Brazilian outback, all-American commuter dad in Westchester County, muscular sportsman and mountaineer and rock climber, and high-end commercial photographer in Manhattan, where his specialty was altering images. Trick photography, my father called it. And then when my father returned to Hungary after the fall of communism, another remake as a quote-unquote 100% Hungarian patriot, a diehard supporter of the current right-wing regime. I came to think of my father as a kind of identity zealot, channeling the last century's biggest marquee struggles over identity. People often see identity as singular and stable, but what I saw with my father was an identity that was multiple and fluid and had many threads. So the next excerpt I want to read you explores the conjunction of two of these many threads, gender and religion. "I love this place," my father declared. "It's authentic Hungarian." We were waiting for a table at the Fish Farm Inn close to the Danube, where my father liked to order the halászlé, a traditional spicy fish soup larded with enough paprika to burn out your brain on the first sip. My father especially loved the old school waiters, elderly gents with formal manners, greeting her with courtly gallantry and pulling out her chair, addressing her with that vintage salutation of men to women, "Kese, chocolum, I kiss your hand." Did they find her womanly? As usual, she wasn't wearing a wig. Her white purse was slung like a sailor's duffel over her blue double-breasted captain's jacket, an ocean-faring motif for a seafood dinner. When the late waiter left the table, I remarked on his deference. "Well, they have to kiss my hand now." "Why?" I said. "Because," she said, "I'm tough." I decided to exercise some toughness of my own. I announced I was foregoing the fish soup. "It's made the correct way here," my father insisted, and proceeded to wear me down with one of her characteristic free-floating filibusters. "Halászlé should only be made with river fish or lake fish, but never salt water. It can be carp, perch, catfish. Now, Lake Balaton's the largest freshwater lake, and..." I said I'd try the soup. The waiter arrived with a cast iron kettle and began ladling out its contents, starting with my father's bowl. "Ladies first," my father quipped. She looked pleased with her own sophistry, a trickster mocking and simultaneously enforcing convention. "Lake Balaton," she said after a while. "That's how we ended up hearing it on the radio." A conversation with her was like a ride in a run-amok submersible. One minute you were bobbing on the surface, the next trawling the ocean floor. Now she was back in the summer of 1944, when my fugitive father and grandfather hid in a doctor's apartment while the doctor holidayed at Lake Balaton. Father and son had listened very quietly to the BBC. "That's how we heard the Germans had taken away the Jews of Kasha," she said now. She was referring to my grandfather's hometown. "My father started to cry," she said. "He told me they have killed my parents." "Did he try to get his parents out?" I asked. My father studied the tablecloth and said nothing. "You did something," I said. "You saved your parents." "That was different," my father said. "I believed it, so they believed it." By they, my father was referring to the Hungarian Arrow Cross, who were guarding the building where my grandparents were held. "I took part in their game," my father said. "If you believe you are whoever you pretend to be, you're halfway saved. But if you act funny, if you act afraid, you're halfway to the gas chamber." My father ordered dessert. Pureed chestnuts laced with rum and vanilla, heaped with whipped cream, and served in a gigantic goblet. My father was a lifelong, had a lifelong sweet tooth, and always had four in the afternoon. We would have to have like a some kind of Viennese torte and espresso, which never seemed to keep him from sleeping. "This role-playing during the war," she said as she tackled the towering confection, "that was a similar process." "Similar to what?" I said. "I can sit down with anyone now, and he kisses my hand," she said. "It strengthened me for life that I did these things back then and that I could get away with it. So now I can do this other thing," meaning her change in sex. "Because if you are convinced you are this other person, everybody else will be convinced." "So what you're doing now," I asked, "is that playing another role too?" "I was role-playing as a man," she said, "but I wasn't totally accepted by women as a capital letter M man. I didn't have the wherewithal. Now, as a woman, I'm not role-playing anymore. Because this is who you were all along, I asked. Well, it's who I am now, she said. Since the operation, I have developed another personality. Which has been easier for you, I asked, to be accepted as a woman after being born a man, or to be accepted as a Hungarian after being born a Jew? My father thought about it, holding her spoon before her like a hand mirror. As a woman, she said, because I am a woman, with a birth certificate that says I'm a woman, so I must be a woman. My father polished off her dessert. So, she said, is the Inquisition over now? She grinned and waved her spoon. The lives and crimes of Stephanie Faludi. Oh, my God. We filed out into the night air. The Danube lay before us, obsidian in darkness. My father tugged at my sleeve. Getting away with it, she said. Susan, don't forget that line. That's the key to it all. Because a lot of people got discovered that they were Jewish and they were shot. So my father obviously conflated in her mind her different struggles with identity. But those struggles weren't just in the past, and they weren't just personal. By the time I was visiting my father, Hungary was going through its own identity crisis, one that has unfortunately led it to the brink of resurgent anti-Semitism and authoritarianism. And it's a big part of the book that I'm sorry to discover is even more relevant than I knew when I wrote it, considering the recent horrific events in Orlando, and also considering the larger current political climate here in the United States. Part of what my book explores is the way that identity can be either liberating, as with LGBT rights, or can be nationalistic, xenophobic, in some cases, downright fascist. And I thought I'd close with an excerpt that shows these two forms of identity colliding. Are you going to be in the parade? I asked. We were washing dishes in my father's kitchen. My father took her time drying her hands on her frilled yellow apron. No. Why not? I asked. We were talking about the one annual public showing of Hungary's LGBT population, the Budapest Gay Dignity Procession. The parade was scheduled for July 5th, a few weeks hence. I did it once, my father said. So? So I don't need to do it again. It's boring. I didn't buy that. The Grand Dame of the Gay Parade, she'd exulted 2 years earlier after the 2006 march. Well, she'd added, old dame, anyway. She'd sent me pictures she'd taken with young revelers, and she couldn't stop talking about it. It's the signature event of the LGBT community, I said. Don't you want to be there? She gave her signature wave of dismissal. It's an irritant. Some of the transes don't dress tastefully, you know? I didn't know, but I knew enough about the parade's reception to be secretly relieved she was planning on missing it. My father stacked the plates in the cupboard. She wiped down the counter slowly and took her time folding the matching yellow floral dish towels. Then she met my eye. There could be trouble, she said. The previous year, right-wing thugs had attacked the paraders as they marched down Andrássy Boulevard and beat up revelers at the after-party at Buda Beach, two so severely that they had to be hospitalized. The police were conspicuously absent. When a parade member called the police, she was told that, having chosen to participate in the march, she, quote, should take its consequences. On the streets of Budapest that day, two assertions of identity had collided with bloody consequences for one of them. In the weeks leading up to this year's procession, the signs were even more ominous. The Hungarian right-wing media and blogosphere were roiling with fury. The communique issued by the rightist Hunia organization was typical. We will not permit aberrant foreigners of this or that color to force their alien and sick world on Hungary. We hereby publicly declare that we ourselves will defend the Hungarian capital. Jobbik parliamentary members attempted to ban the parade and later introduced legislation to make the, quote, promotion of sexual deviations, including homosexuality, transsexuality, transvestism, bisexuality, and pedophile behaviors, unquote, punishable by up to 8 years in prison. In June, the far-right website Kuruk posted the names and addresses of LGBT gathering spots in Budapest. A few days later, a gay bar and bathhouse, both on the website's list, were firebombed. Kuruk hailed the attacks in a post titled, quote, Cleansing Fire Licks Another Mini-Sodom. By then, more than a dozen Hungarian far-right groups were mobilizing against the march. The Hungarian Self-Defense Movement announced its intent to attack the parade and appealed to, quote, all Hungarians to expel the pederast horde once and for all. A soccer fan club promised to meet the marchers with, quote, weapons if we must, with bare hands if we must, but we will not let things stand as they are. The opening ceremonies of the 2008 Gay Pride Festival were held in a downtown theater. The former equality minister, Catalin Levoyi, delivered the keynote speech. She talked about the rights and the desires of LGBT people to build a community by making their identity public. A community, she said, may only find dignity if it becomes visible. But the threats convinced many, like my father, to stay home. The day of the Gay Dignity Procession, bands of self-styled Hungarian patriots broke through the police barricades and hurled smoke bombs, firecrackers, cobblestones, bottles, acid-filled eggs, rotting food, and feces. They accosted parade-goers and policemen alike, beat up a well-known liberal radio reporter, and attacked a Roma performer so viciously that the march's concert had to be canceled. They slapped and spat at a socialist politician who was on record as supporting the march and smashed the windows of the car carrying the former equality minister and the first openly gay government official. Marchers fled through an underground tunnel to the nearest subway station. In the course of the dignity procession, the predictable epithets were hurled. Dirty queers, filthy fags, and so on. One particular chant, though, seemed to capture the crowd's fancy. It was heard all along the parade route. Búzakat a duna bo zidokat meg utano. Faggots into the Danube, followed by the Jews. So, on that not very cheerful note, I think I'll stop and hear your thoughts and questions. Oh, thank you. I think we have microphones. I thought you were going to be the brave soul. Oh, you are. Good.
Hi, my name is James. I'm very curious what your opinion is. I sort of came in midway through the talk, so I'm not sure if this sort of fits within the context of what your talk is about. But I'm very curious about what your opinion is about left-wing feminists or feminists in general who align themselves with the right on specific issues or certain issues, those being the ones that come to my mind right off the top of my head being Camille Paglia, Tammy Bruce, or, of course, Andrea Dworkin, probably the most famous example of that. I'm very curious what your opinion is about feminists like that, and if you've had interactions with those feminists and what your what those interactions were in general.
Well, I actually never had the privilege of meeting Andrea Dworkin. I wish I had, and some of you may know she died a few years ago. Camille Paglia, I have had encounters with. I'm not sure I would call her a feminist.
Right.
In that she, or at least I will say that her right. feminism and my feminism right. don't have, you know,
yeah.
much common ground. And Tammy Bruce, I think I met once many years ago. But I'm not quite sure how to answer your question. Feminism has sort of multiplied into feminisms. My feminism, which all I can probably speak for, is one in which I believe that in relevance to this, what we're discussing
Sorry.
Tonight, which
Sorry.
Is, oh no, it's okay.
Yeah.
the question of transgender, I think is actually very much in accord with this new generation or contemporary generation of trans theorists, and that I believe gender is a fluid commodity, and that it's a good thing to challenge the gender binary. And I'm not sure how Camille Paglia comes down on that, but I'm sure we will hear.
I know as a lesbian.
We always
yeah,
hear.
I know as Camille Paglia's identity as a lesbian is interesting in that she's recently come out very much against sort of the gay rights agenda or the gay identity mm-hmm. agenda. And it's an interesting shift that she identifies as a lesbian in that sense proudly, but also is very vocal in denouncing many parts of the gay rights agenda. Mm-hmm. I find that very an interesting binary there.
Yeah, well, it's, I guess sort of like her calling herself a feminist and then denouncing feminists.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. She's
provocative. I think that's her main consistent.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Sure.
So as you got to know your father, did you discover more feminine qualities in him after the surgery? And then did you, sort of looking back, did you see those qualities when he was a man?
Mm. Thank you. That's a good question. You know, my father wasn't particularly feminine in, you know, whatever that means. When I was growing up, but you know, looking back, I think my father was trying on many kind of masks and identities and roles, and was really, you know, has sort of adopted a very hyper masculine persona. And looking back, it seemed to me that, you know, that in fact was a way of pushing out deeper feelings. At the same time, leading up to the operation and right in the year or so after the operation, my father embraced a rather, to my mind, cliched kind of 1950s girly femininity that seems straight out of, you know, a Marilyn Monroe movie. And I began to, you know, later realize that perhaps my father needed to go to that extreme of hyper femininity to sort of break out of the carapace of extreme masculinity. So she had to hammer through many layers that she had imposed on herself, and later. And, you know, in the last years of her life, my father became much more sort of comfortable with who she was in ways that didn't have so much to do with its gender. I mean, sort of put that down as something that had to be projected out in the world. And I would like to think became more herself, which is what we all want, ultimately.
I believe I read this in a review of your book. I don't know that it's in the book, but it was a remark about an interview with the doctor doing this gender reassignment surgery who claimed that, who was asked how happy are the people after the surgery, And he said, well, out of 100, maybe 6 or 8.
Oh, yeah, that's not a doctor, but go ahead.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I couldn't remember, but I wondered about your comments about that, both generally, but in relation to your father.
Yeah, you know, that that was actually, Melanie Myers, who then became, well, who started out as Mel, became Melanie Myers and then went back to being a man. And Mel, it's, he wound up, ran this sort of recovery house, sort of guest house in Thailand that for post-op transsexuals who, you know, needed to recover before they could get back on the plane. It was called Melanie's Cocoon, and my father spent quite a bit of time there. And it just so happened, Melanie, who then became Mel, spent half the year in Thailand and half the year in Portland, Oregon, where I was living at the time. So we got to know each other and became friends. And what Mel was saying there was actually not that, oh, people regret it, because in fact, the studies or surveys of people who've had gender reassignment surgeries, the majority of them don't regret it. What Mel was saying was that it's very hard to pass, and he felt that out of 100, only very few can pull it off in a way that makes them feel comfortable. And I think Mel was mainly talking about himself and some of the other people he knew who really suffered for, you know, feeling that they weren't accepted. I have to say, for my father never expressed any regret. And I think was completely comfortable with, you know, that was maybe one of the few decisions my father made that she could live with.
And she was accepted?
Well, you know, I think because my father has this sort of brazen, you know, of all the places to pick to be trans, Hungary would not be on the top of my list, you know. And we did at the beginning have this experience where we'd be walking through Budapest, and there were these, you know, sort of very disapproving, you know, sort of elderly, matronly women who would sort of glower. But after a while, I realized that they did a lot of glower. They would glower at me. So I was never sure. And, you know, my father, I think the thing that was most wonderful is my father had a lifelong struggle to just connect with other people. And the one thing that she talked about a lot was that, you know, after the surgery, she felt that she could begin to communicate with people, and particularly with women. And she, several neighbors who were sort of keeping their distance before, because my father could be really explosive and just really, really angry, became close to friends with my father. And that was a big leap forward. So.
Thank you. Hi, I'm halfway through your book, and I'm truly astounded and amazed, and I think it's incredible that you're doing this.
Thank you.
My question is, given what you've learned and what you've lived, do you have more questions now that your father has passed that are difficult or unable to be answered, or they're still becoming answerable as you go?
That's a good question. I mean, I wake up in the middle of the night thinking, and often thinking, oh, I have to ask Stephanie. And I'm like, oh, no, I can't. I mean, my father died a year ago. And, you know, there are lots of sort of specific questions, details. And I wish, you know, and I wish there were one of, you know, the problems that anybody who's written about the Holocaust knows. I mean, we're at this period where everybody you want to talk to is like 90-something years old. And in the course, just in the last year, there are a couple people in the book who've died. So, you know, it's not just my father, but there are other people around my father that I wish I could have talked to. But I think they sort of... sort of the emotional core, I feel as much as my father could open up and let me in, she did. And, you know, I'm grateful for that.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
May I ask, first of all, thank you for Backlash many, many years ago. It had
Thanks.
A great influence on my thinking, and I'm very grateful. What I'm not hearing is anything about your mother. I can't imagine living with your father. And so I wonder where she was or is.
My mother can't imagine living with my mom.
She's still alive.
Yes. And, well, you know, I shared the manuscript with her, and she gave me her thoughts. But, you know, my father asked me to write her story. My mother did not, and my mother and my brother are private people, so I want to honor that privacy. And also, I'm sure all of you have experienced with family, we all have our singular responses. I mean, sometimes you think, oh, do I live in the same family as you do? And so I wouldn't want to presume to opine on either my mother's experience or my brother's experience. You know, it's hard when it's hard on families when you write a memoir or you just have a writer in the family, and they've been very gracious and tolerant of all that.
Hi.
Hi.
So I've been reading about Martine Rothblatt lately.
I'm sorry?
Martine Rothblatt. Who's
a
trans woman who
is like
the founder of Sirius
Radio.
And the biotech firm. And one thing that I found very interesting about her was that she stayed in her relationship. And I guess maybe the age of your father's transition might kind of make this sort of not necessarily as relevant. But I was wondering whether your father's, whether her sexuality seemed different afterwards, whether she's still, whether she was straight or was gay as a woman. That's really what I was wondering.
Good question. Yeah. Well, it was interesting because my father always had this notion of, okay, I mean, there was a struggle between this is what's expected of me and this is what I have to do to be accepted. And so my father said, okay, well, now that I'm a woman, I, you know, have to be involved with a man. But then my father never got involved with a man and actually stayed close to the girlfriend that that she had had for many years in Budapest, and then later, you know, became close to another woman. And so I don't. And as you say, you know, at the age of 76, at some point, this became sort of a moot question anyway. But yeah, I don't think, you know, she as far as I know, and my father was a big proponent of TMI. I mean, there was very little that my father wouldn't tell me, so I imagine that she would have told me. She just continued to be drawn to women as far as I could tell.
Thank you. I wonder, through the process of your exploration in writing this book, whether you gained any insight into, in the area of gender fluidity, why some feel compelled towards surgery and others do not?
This is one of those areas where, as much as I did a lot of reading, researched the sort of history of transsexuality and how it got diagnosed, and talked to a lot of trans authorities and trans activists, I used all that to illuminate my father's story, but that's different from becoming an expert on those sort of questions. I mean, I haven't done scientific research, I think I may take a pass on that. I only know that my father proceeded to this point, you know, I mean, for some people, it's just a matter of whether they can afford it or not. For others, it's there's a desire to sort of live in a more liminal, you know, middle space. I mean, the part of the appeal is that, okay, I'm not going to fit into these molds. I think for some, perhaps for some much older people of my father's generation, you know, who grew up with you've got to be one thing or another, there's more of a push toward that.
Hi. That your last comment leads to the question that I have. When you in the last excerpt you read, your father said seemed to be not wanting to participate in this Gay Pride Day because of fear of violence or something like that. But I wonder if there isn't also a kind of a cultural, a generational cultural divide. That is, I mean, he was a very idiosyncratic person, certainly unique. But in the end, especially in the certain early phases of the transition, she seemed to be kind of bourgeois in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And there's a way in which transsexuals are part of queer culture, part of gay culture, that's sort of specific to a certain generation, mm-hmm. a certain set of politics, and so forth. And so I wonder if there was a way in which she felt kind of separate or alienated from the sort of mainstream of queer, if you can say such a thing, the mainstream of queer culture, yeah. by her generation, by her Judaism, by her, you know, her biography, anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and put on top of that she was in Hungary.
Right,
which,
right.
So at one point, and I talk about this in the book, my father has a party at her house to introduce me to the trans community of Budapest. And these were, and they were all trans women and one man who hadn't really, who identified as a transvestite. And some of the, and they, except for the one who identified as a transvestite, they were all much younger. There, you know, there was that disconnect. For one thing, I mean, politically, my father was like, oh, you know, the old Hungary, if we could only bring back the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And that didn't go over very well with the youngsters. So, yeah, I mean, my father was cut off in so many other ways, too. And you know, was so alone with this for so many years. I mean, completely alone. I mean, I didn't tell anyone, clearly no one in our family. That was a very lonely existence for many, many years.
Sorry to take a second turn, but I was also prompted by something you said, which was that your father died just a year ago. And, of course, he asked you to write his story. Did he get a chance to read your book and manuscript, and how did he react?
Well, you know, it's really interesting because I, you know, when I had a readable manuscript, I presented it and said, you know, it's ready, and you know the editor likes it, and to which my father just said, "Oh, in those drawn out Hungarian files, oh, it's fantastic," but then didn't want to read it. And I've puzzled over that a lot. My father was, I mean, some months after that, my father began to become ill, and at that point, you know, I just think didn't, you know, kind of have the concentration or bandwidth to read much of anything. Although she continued to, you know, to the last days in the hospital, announcing to people, "My daughter is about to publish a book on me." So I think that what my father wanted was most of all was to be perceived. And it didn't, and, you know, it was less important that that she vet the final project than it was to feel that somebody had seen, you know, had perceived her. In a funny way, maybe, you know, what surprised me is that here's my father, who was sort of an obsessive Photoshopper before the days of Photoshop, always wanting to control and edit any sort of image of herself, and yet she let go of that. And I think she must have made a decision early on in inviting me sort of back into her life to tell her story, that she wanted me to tell the story, warts and all. I know she would often brag to people, well, my daughter, she's, you know, she never pulls any punches when she's reporting. She's going to get to the bottom of this. So I think that's what she wanted.
Okay. I have a question, a two-parter. You met your father, he was much older, and you had always known him as a man, as your father.
Mm-hmm.
With a very stormy childhood, it sounds like.
Right.
Not a necessarily happy relationship from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of a two-parter. I don't know what your father looked like. I don't know if he was a very masculine-looking person. Were you ever able, in all of your ongoing relationship with him until he died, able to, or not able, did you perceive him as a woman at any point?
Mm-hmm.
Did it seem to you, this is my father pretending to be a woman? Pretending mm-hmm. is not exactly the right word, because if he's trans, but
right.
Were you ever able to incorporate that this mm-hmm. really is a woman,
mm-hmm.
number one? And number two, were you able to in any way sort of reconcile what he had done to the entire family in your past
mm-hmm.
leading up to this? Even though psychologically you can understand what his struggle was, and maybe that's why he was
mm-hmm.
the way he was. But were you able to, did any of your feelings of your past sort of soften seeing what his life had been
mm-hmm.
like leading up to this?
Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks. Those are two good questions. Well, you know, my father's desire to be a woman was undeniable, and I accepted that. You know, I think actually much harder to deal with were, you know, the ways my father held on to who she used to be. We certainly disagreed on what it being a woman meant, and I certainly took issue with this, you know, like, oh, being a woman, according to my father, meant, you know, being in the kitchen, and one of my father's favorite phrases early on was the dumb, you know, here I am being the dumb broad. Or she would say, you know, you write about the disadvantages of being a woman, and I see only the advantages. So we had, we had struggles over that. But, over the years, that became, that sort of, the whole argument receded. And I think because, you know, when you know somebody that long, you're not seeing them in a category, you're seeing them as them, with all, you know, all the things that made them, of which gender is a part, but not everything. And as far as, dressing as a woman, all that just, I have to say that, I guess because it's sort of ephemeral, external anyway, that was something I just, there was a very quick adjustment period. And on the second question about the violence and how I dealt with that later, I mean, my father, we finally sat down and talked about it. Toward the end of my father's life, there was, and I talk about this in the book, we were in the Orthodox synagogue where she, as a child, would go, went every Sabbath. And my father started saying the blessing from parent to child, over me as we were sitting there, and then suddenly turned to me and said, you know, I was wrong what I did, when referring to a violent moment that actually, and that involved me hitting my head against the floor. And I took that as a sort of global apology for the many other violent and ugly moments of my childhood inflicted, not just on me, but on the rest of the family. So it didn't exonerate my father's behavior in any way. I was still certainly on my mother's side on that. But we did get to a point, I mean, forgiveness is different than saying, oh, never mind, I forgot all about that. She think, genuinely expressed contrition, and I expressed deep regret for letting so many years go by without, you know, healing that breach between us. So.
Did you want to go?
To the extent that one finds, you know, I mean, I'm not a big believer in closure and, you know, letting the healing begin, but I am deeply, I feel deeply fortunate that I had all those years with my father, and that we, you know, we came to really see each other and sort of see each other whole, and that's, you know, that's wonderful. I mean, I think... So many of us as children see our parents' power and the power over us, and to be able to see a parent's frailties and vulnerabilities and to stop seeing them as a caricature and see them as fully human was a great gift for me that my father gave me. So, thank you so much. Oh, good. Yes, Janetta.
Sister Susan. In the interest of telling truths, not truth, but truths, I want to first say that I am running for an office, and I know that there's a lot of competition because I'm running for the position of president of the Susan Faludi fan club.
I was hoping you would say U.S. president.
Susan, it's really hard to find words because I'm so struck by your courage, first of all.
Thank you.
Just your sheer courage. And I'm anticipating what it's going to be like to struggle with you and through you in this book. One of the things that happened to me tonight in listening to these really amazing and really grace-filled readings was that I was taken back to a point in my youth when I was a student at Oberlin College, taking a course called Racial and Cultural Minorities, taught by Simpson and Yinger. And I started to fixate on what Simpson and Yinger helped us, said the two beloved professors, to understand as the definition of a Jew. Someone who believed to be and publicly announced to be a Jew, and importantly, someone accepted as, viewed by others to be a Jew. And in this struggle around multiple identities that we're all finally beginning to do and getting rid of singularities, there goes the black one, there goes the lesbian one, there goes the Jew, there goes the Muslim. It did strike me how basic that lesson was, because your father declared his womanness, but it was meaningless until you, Susan, and others declared it with him. So I know this isn't really in the form of a question. Early on, I had a question. I said, I'm going up with my question. But this is more, I guess it is a question in the sense of seeking your affirmation of this notion which goes beyond your dad and you. It is that we humans really do require others to acknowledge who we are. And that becomes an important role that we can play in the lives of others. I'm winning this campaign. I'm going to be the president.
Thank you. And I don't think I can add to that other than to say, yes, that, you know, I came over to get to the bottom of my father, but I think I was also sort of a big reflecting mirror for my father, in which my father could finally find herself through my recognition of who she was. So thank you all so much for coming.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.